UK Wine Show, show number 179 for the 16th of October 2009. Vino Logs with Siegfried Landskrona. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we have another great show. We're going to be interviewing Siegfried Landskrona on Vino Log, how it works and what it is, what are its benefits and what are its problems. In the spotlight, we have another great book review. This time we're reviewing Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion, a book so thick it keeps my front door open in the breeze. I also have a copy to give away for a lucky listener to the show. Now, I'm putting this podcast together quite early in the week. Usually, as most of you guys know, I try to get it ready on Friday, and as some of you know, it sometimes goes out on Saturday and Sunday if we're really busy. But this week, I'm going to be at the wine show in Islington, helping people get the most out of their wine. Do pop in and say hello if you are at the Islington Wine Show. It starts on Thursday and Friday, Saturday and Sunday. So the show's going to be going up late on Thursday, so give you plenty of time to pop down and say hello. Or even follow me on Twitter. I've set up an account there, so follow me at Winescriber. And finally this week, before we jump into the news, we have our mystery grape. I know last week's mystery region was a bit of a tough one, but this one should be a lot easier. In fact, it should be easy peasy lemon squeezy, as my two-year-old would say. So, here goes the grape. A mid-season ripener in Bordeaux, it can bring very deep colour, ample tannins to create a great base for blending wines. It's also planted in New Zealand, Chile, California and Argentina, and Australia, where it's used in blends rather than making a single varietal. Have we ponder about that? I'll give you another clue, which should help you out a lot more after the news. Coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Twitter has launched two wines under the brand Fledgling Wine in a joint initiative with Crushpad, a San Francisco-based winery, and charity Room to Read. A $5 donation will be made to the charity for every bottle sold to help provide books and libraries in some of the poorest areas of the world and to ultimately help boost literacy rates. The two wines are a Pinot Noir and a Chardonnay, but won't be bottled until August 2010, and so until then will only be available to pre-order at £20 a bottle via the website fledglingwine.com. Twitter's co-founders Biz Stone and Evan Williams said they believe Fledgling Wine will help Twitter as well, because if you can't read, they say, you can't tweet.
Twitter's making branded wine in the US to raise funds for charity. Crushpad are going to produce it. It certainly is a conversation starter at dinner parties, particularly when you look at the label and it says ABC, which in wine speak means anything but Chardonnay. So it's interesting that they're making a Chardonnay labelled ABC. I hope they make loads of money for charity, but it's not just the odd tech company launching wine. British tabloid newspaper The Sun has launched a wine in collaboration with UK major supermarket Asda. The Vino di Sole, a blend of Vermentino and Viognier, is a collaboration between the Red Top's resident wine writer Brian Moore and Asda's chief wine buyer Philippa Carr. What's up next, Jane?
Well, next there's reports that UK alcohol consumption is falling at the fastest rate for more than 60 years. That's according to HM Revenue and Customs data released by the British Beer and Pub Association, or the BBPA. In the first 6 months of 2009, consumption fell by over 8% to 3.8 litres of pure alcohol per person, a drop of 8% versus the 4.1 litres per head in the same period of 2008. According to the data, drinking levels in the UK have been steadily declining since a peak in 2004 of 9.5 litres of alcohol per head per year. But while consumption's down, alcohol-related hospital admissions are regularly reported to be rising, when theoretically admissions should be declining. According to the BBPA, the consumption data shows that the theory of reducing everyone's drinking to tackle alcohol harm doesn't work in practice, and that targeted policies would be more effective. They say that despite this clear trend, the government continues to press ahead with a wide range of measures designed to control alcohol consumption at a national level. Chief Executive Bridget Simmons said there needs to be a new debate about effective policy measures that are clearly targeting a minority who misuse alcohol.
Well, 3.8 litres of pure alcohol in 6 months sounds like a great party. But it works out to be around 81 bottles per year, with a 12.5% alcohol level, or just over 1.5 bottles a week. Not too bad. Now, if we make a wild assumption here that half the country are completely teetotal, then we're consuming about the government guidelines in terms of targets. So it's certainly not a case that we're all overdoing it. It's just a few who are going a bit too far. The question that I find interesting isn't so much what the BBPA were talking about the debate, but whether the drop in consumption is a function of the recession that we're in, or whether it's a change in attitude. We won't know that for the next year or two when we're out of the current recession. What's the last question, Jane?
The International Wine and Spirit Competition has announced results for Southern Hemisphere wines this week, as well as the overall trophy winners for all the categories in the competition. Villa Maria Cellar Selection Sauvignon Blanc 2009 won a gold best in class, as well as picking up the trophy for best Sauvignon Blanc. And the Southern Hemisphere picked up more trophies overall than their Northern Hemisphere counterparts. Although English wine producer Nye Timber stood out for winning a trophy for the best bottle fermented sparkling wine of the competition with their 1992 Blanc de Blanc. That's all from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Producer Nye Timber won the IWSC Best in Class for their 1992 fizz. That's great news. The category was bottle fermented sparkling wines, and it doesn't include champagne. Either way, it's still great news for Nye Timber to beat the rest of the world. What interests me is the wines from their current vintage. These are good, but they do suffer from bottle variation. Whenever I open up Nye Timber, I feel a bit like playing Russian roulette. It could be absolutely sublime, or it can be downright dodgy. For me, the question is, should this be the price for great wine? No, it's not, because one of the things about great wine is its consistency. Let's hope the wines become a bit more consistent as the new winemaking team start to release wines that they've made in the last couple of years. In Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion, Nye Timber got 2 to 3 stars out of 4, which I pretty much agree with. I think it's about right. And we're going to be reviewing Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion 6th edition by Stephen Brook next. So here we go, the spotlight looking at Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion. Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion is a huge doorstop of a wine, measuring 4.5 centimetres in its hardback form, and it certainly has the size of a great reference book. But reference books are not just about size, it's about the quality of the topics covered. And Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion does an excellent job. The 672 pages of the companion focus on producers, regions, and appellation systems. All are written with effortless prose, not overly verbose, but from a master craftsman. The region information is well written, conveying both a sense of wine style and culture. And it contains probably the best collection of Appellation Controller listings that I've seen, describing the Appellation Controllers for regions and wine styles. Not just for France, but the DOCs, the DOCGs from all over Europe. But it's the detailed information about the producers that make up the bulk of the book. These can range from one sentence to pages, depending on the importance. All are given a star rating out of 4 to reflect the quality of the producer, and while rankings are subjective, I am in broad agreement with the Vineyard rankings. But it's the pedigree rather than the quality of the rankings that I have concern for. According to publisher Octopus, part of Michael Beasley Publishing, 70% of Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion 6th edition has been updated since the 5th edition. As Stephen Brook was the person doing the revisions on the 6th edition and the 5th edition, it's pretty much safe to say this book has been written by Stephen Brook rather than Hugh Johnson. In which case, congratulations are in order. Stephen's writing is fluid and well-crafted. Stephen or Hugh, I'm not sure which, has included an appendix of a shortened set of 26 maps, mostly from Hugh and Jensen Robinson's World Atlas. These are excellent and give a perfect overview set of maps. After the maps, the last section, enjoying wine, at the end of the book, and an introduction to grapes, viticulture and vinification and techniques at the start, are nicely written, but they're not inspiring if you've read several of these books before. There are some nice touches. A listing of principal grape varieties by country of origin is nice, rather than just listing them alphabetically. And I can tell that the Wine Companion is already becoming one of my key wine reference books. The sheer number of producers and the appellation system list are excellent. What I like is it gives a very solid overview of the different appellations and the wines that make them up. It is the best single source of appellations that I've come across, but these are both a minor point. Most of the book is dedicated to listing key producers. I think this book would suit most wine enthusiasts, and it's a great companion to A Wine Atlas, complementing it rather than competing with it. In the end, I gave this a great rating of 93 out of 100, which makes it one of the better books around. I do have a copy of Hugh Johnson's Wine Companion to give away. Sadly, again, it is limited to the UK, as it's such a big, heavy book, shipping it overseas is just not sensible. But I will give out a couple of books in the next wee while that can be shipped overseas. So for this week, if you want the wine book, please send me your name and address to chris.scott at 3050thirtyfifty.co.uk. That's chris.scott at 3050thirtyfifty.co.uk. Or you can go through our website, 3050.co.uk, and use the Contact Us. Select the UK Wine Show. While you're there, you can set yourself up to receive our monthly newsletter, and I will be giving away another copy of the Hugh Johnson Wine Companion in November's newsletter for our subscribers, so maybe have two cracks at the whip, so to speak. Send me your answer by Thursday next week, along with the delivery address where you want it to be sent to, and I'll announce the winner on next week's show. Next week, we're going to be doing a quick review of Concise Wine Atlas, which came out a couple of months ago. Again, I have another copy of that to give away, so I'll give you more information on that next week. As I said in the book review, the Wine Companion does have a section at the front giving the names of grapes, and it does include this week's mystery grape. If you haven't worked it out yet, and to be honest, I tricked you a wee bit in terms of the first one because it is quite an easy grape to get, here is the second clue and should make it a bit more obvious. This black grape is used to make wines in Bordeaux, the Loire, and southwest France, where it's grown under a number of different names. In Argentina, its adopted land, the grape can create both fruity-driven, plummy-like characters, while in Cahors in southwest France, it tends to produce gamey aromas and has quite considerable aging potential. Now, that should give it away, particularly the clue about Argentina. If you haven't worked it out yet, I'm going to give you the answer after this week's interview with Siegfried Landskrona, all about Vinolock, the glass wine closure. Let's have a listen to that. Hi, I'm here with Siegfried Landskrona. How are you, Siegfried?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, Chris.
All right, you're from Closure Systems International, CSI?
That's correct.
Sounds like a TV program.
No, it's not a TV program. It's Closure Systems International. We are one of the market leaders in providing the beverage and dairy and, in general, the beverage industry with screw caps, aluminum, as well as plastic screw caps.
Okay, but today we're going to be talking about Vinolock.
Absolutely.
Vinolock's unusual closure in so much as it's glass. And a wee bit unusual. Do you want to tell us, before we get into that, though, a wee bit about the history? Because I understand CSI, or Closure Systems International, has changed ownership, and it's now owned by Kiwi, I understand.
That's correct. We have changed ownership. We are now part of a very large packaging group specialized really on good packaging products. And our owner indeed is in New Zealand.
Hey! Okay. Okay. You obviously produce a lot of screw caps.
Yes.
But Vinolock is a closure I've seen around for a long time now. When did it first get developed?
Yeah, well, we started with a development in 2002, 2003, when somebody had an idea that glass on glass might be a very good solution if it works as an alternative to natural corks, particularly in wine, when the big discussion came up in regard of cork taste and all the other discussion around that. So the development has started 2002, and in 2004 we have started to go live, if you like, which means commercial production.
Okay, so what you say glass on glass, do you want to just describe what a Vinolock is?
Yeah, the Vinolock concept means that we are using a glass stopper to be part of the package for wine, and there is only a very small liner system between the glass bottle and the Vinolock from glass, and this is a whole system that protects the wine. And it is a perfect serving tool also for the consumers.
The liner that you say is, it looks like plastic, but it sort of feels almost like silicon.
Yeah, it's a non-PVC liner, which means we are using only the liners which are suitable, particular when it comes to long-term performance.
I presume it's food grade. And what?
Yeah, yeah, it's specifically a lager which is suitable for using for all kinds of foods, and of course including beverage and including wine. And it's a proven system also from wine institutes around the globe.
So what are the advantages? You say you talked about glass on glass, but in actual fact it's glass, plastic glass, isn't it really?
Yeah, but the glass part that you can't see is only a very, very minor part. So the contact between wine and this liner is less than a tenth of a millimeter, if you like. So in fact, what happens is that with a Vinalox system, the wine system or the package system is, I would say, 98% covered by glass instead of having other materials in contact with wine.
Okay, but you've still got a wee bit of plastic there. How does it stay in the bottle? Because it, like a cork stays in just because of the pressure.
Yeah.
How does this stay in the bottle?
Yeah, what we have is, number one, we can click in the Vinalock because we have a certain sealing system developed, a kind of O-ring system developed. And as a first protection for the long-term performance, mechanical performance, there is an aluminum cap over the Vinalock. So this is really something which holds very tight so that the Vinalock can stay in also in very difficult logistics systems, transport systems across the ocean, temperatures up and downs.
So the aluminium cap, is that a bit like a screw cap that goes over the top? Or
It's not a screw cap, it's an aluminum cap, which is right, which has a certain fixing, and you can open it without any tool. You can just twist it to the left or to the right, and then you can take off the aluminum cap, and then you can see the Vinalock as a closure sealing the bottle.
Okay, and pulling the Vino lock out, pretty easy, or is it quite hard? Do you need a knife to pry it off?
No. It's a kind of click that you can do. You can just do it with one finger, and then it's clicking out of the bottle, and you even can reuse it. So if you have some concerns to drink one bottle of wine just in once, you can click on the Vino lock, you can put it back into the fridge if it's a white wine, and then you can drink it, start to drink next day again. It holds very fresh. So it's a kind of a second advantage.
What are the performance criteria? And I suppose when I'm talking about performance, I suppose I'm talking about things like oxygen ingress, how much oxygen bleeds into the wine, because that's the big problem with plastic closures is definitely the amount of oxygen they bleed in. Corks, the variable amount of oxygen they bleed in. Some corks in the same batch can make marked differences. And perhaps the problem with screw caps historically is that they don't let that much oxygen in.
That's correct.
So what's the issue here?
In general, when we're talking about wine closures, we need to separate two big groups. One is a group that allows some kind of oxygen going in and going out, as you said, natural corks, synthetic corks. Then there is a category which we call alternative wine closures, which are the categories of a short cap, if you like, a screw cap, and the long cap, which means a screw cap with a long skirt, as well as a Vinalock. And they are absolutely gas tight, which means they do not allow gas coming in or coming out. So this is a category of closures where the Vinalock belongs to.
All right, the short cap and long cap. The long cap is your normal screw cap you see on wine bottles.
Yeah, and this is what particularly see in New Zealand and Australia very much. Meanwhile, it's in a growing market segment. Yeah,
and the short cap, that's more like what tomato.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same kind of principle. The only difference is that it has not such a long metal skirt.
Yeah.
So very often used in wines that you have in restaurants.
And olive oil?
Olive oil is also possible. And by the way, the Vinalock is even in use for olive oil and a couple of spirits like vodka. And we have a project with whiskey. So there are different applications possible.
Okay, so Vinalock, we're talking about the oxygen ingress then. So what sort of performance, how does it compare to, say, the cork and the screw cap?
What our information from the test that has been done with the wine institutes is that the Vinalock has the same performance than a long cap, and it has absolutely no exchange between the atmosphere and the wine itself. There are still a couple of wineries where the discussion is that the closure needs to breathe like a cork. But the Vinalock, as I said, it's belonging to the category which is absolutely gas tight, like the long cap.
But the plastic will let some oxygen in.
No,
but
no, it's absolutely close.
Yeah, because I've seen, I've spoken to people from Zork in the past, and they say, you know, the plastic does let some oxygen through. They've got a tin liner, but a small amount of plastic is there, and oxygen does bleed through the plastic.
Yeah, but the Zork system is a completely different system. So the Wienerlock system and the sealing system is built on all the experience we have from our standard closure business. And if you see the sealing systems that we are using in the beverage world, they are absolutely oxygen tight, so there is no oxygen going out and going in. And this is a similar system with Wienerlock.
Okay. Well, a non-oxygen environment for aging wine is obviously a concern for some people. I was doing some judging at the International Wine Challenge a couple of months ago, and the number of wines we saw that had reductive notes, reductive is those, some people describe them as cauliflower and garlic, but yeah. You know, they can be minerally flavors and all sorts of strange aromas. And that sulfur chemistry, as it was described to me by an expert once, is an issue. And even things like screw caps, where they're changing the wadding now, so you've got some control over the oxygen ingress.
I think there is a big debate inside of the wine industry. There are still a category of wineries that have a strong belief that a wine need for aging a certain oxygen exchange. And then there is another category which says, no, this is absolutely not necessary, because usually the oxygen in the headspace is good enough to do that. This is an area where we don't step into in this discussion, because this is wine philosophy. So what we can provide is a technical system, and with Wienerlock particular, a marketing closure for the wineries, and they need to decide whether they would like to have a closure system that is allowing oxygen coming in and out. Then it would be a natural cork, and in some respect also the synthetic corks, or they are moving to the other front, which are the gas tight, maybe this is the right word, closure systems like long cap, Wienerlocks and others.
Okay, I've seen screw caps that have been quite good for, you know, high quality white wines, yeah. Where aging isn't a real issue. In fact, things like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, and where, you know, the younger the better is sometimes the way to go. Yeah. Who's buying Wienerlock, and what sort of wines are they using it for?
Yeah, we can say we are now selling across the globe. However, the core market that we are in is right now, it's still Europe, but also in Napa Valley, there are a couple of wineries using Wienerlock since 4 or 5 years. Some wineries in Australia and even in South Africa. I would not even say that the majority is on white wine. However, maybe it's somewhere around 50-60% on white wine, but at least 40% also on red wine.
On Wienerlock, no.
Yeah, with Wienerlock, on red wine also.
Which countries though?
We are talking about Germany. We are talking about even in Napa Valley, a couple of red wines are also sealed with Wienerlock. It's very much depending what is the strategy of the winery. If we see the behavior of the consumer today, there is a certain group of consumer that would like to store the wines for 5-6 years in the cellar. Mm-hmm. But the majority, which means the key market, is a consumer of today that is going to buy a wine and try to consume it at least within the next 1 to 2 or even 3 years.
And in the UK, it's usually 1 or 2 hours.
So which means the challenge for the wineries has been changed, as far as we understand, during the last couple of years, which means they try even to create now red wines that are almost ready to serve.
Yep.
Instead of having wines where they have to tell their clients, you can buy this wine now and you can open it when you are 80 years old. And this is a market segment where I personally believe, and what we heard from the wineries, they also changed their way of preparing the wines for consumption.
Yeah, so they're doing things like micro-oxidization, where they're bubbling oxygen through the wine to soften tannins and things like that, which I suppose if the wine's been exposed to a fair bit of oxygen during the manufacturing, inhibiting their excess isn't probably a big issue later on.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and what country, you said that it's quite popular for wineries in South Africa, Germany and America, but what about the consumer's acceptance of Wienerlock?
Yeah, this is. We just recently had a little study on the consumers and also on the wineries that that we are serving with Vinalock. And interesting is, in the beginning of the development, our key area was to focus on a good alternative closure in regard of the performance to avoid cork off taste and more of the technical side. Meanwhile, with our study, less than 4% of the market is even questioning the performance, the technical performance of the Vinalock. The majority is looking the Vinalock as a part of their marketing concept for marketing wine. The consumer acceptance is absolutely fantastic. It's a kind of combination of the old tradition of the wine culture, because still a lot of people have a little bit the kind of resistance to use a screw cap on a good wine that they would like to serve with their friends and guests and at rendezvous. But the Vinalock, they like it very much also from the habit, from the appearance. So it's absolutely a good marketing tool, and the consumer do like it very much. The other advantage is, it's more the modern world that for opening a bottle with Vinalock, you don't need any tool at all, which means you have a combination of convenience opening, a perfect sealing, and you have even this this wine appearance.
Wine appearance?
Yeah, well, this, let's say, or wine image.
Okay, yeah. It looks like a nice closure. It doesn't look like a cheap closure.
No, it's not cheap
some,
at all.
Some people say that screw cap looks a wee bit cheap. I don't necessarily agree with that, but some people say that, whereas this looks like a nice closure. Okay, and in terms of market share, where are you with market share? Because, like, you look at screw cap in New Zealand, really quite dominant now.
Right.
It's the dominant closure, but I really don't see a lot of Vinalock wines. Maybe I'm just not drinking the right wines.
No. It's definitely a market there where we can grow in. With a Vinalock, we need to build a kind of a new infrastructure, which means we need to create a market that a local bottle manufacturer are producing a Vinalock bottle where the Vinalock can be applied
on. You need special bottles.
Exactly. So from that point of view, we have started in Europe. We have built the infrastructure. And as if we are moving forward into other countries, we need to build an infrastructure around the Vinalock. So from a market share point of view, we are selling right now somewhere around 25 million closures per year. And if you see the big market, so it's the market share is not very big, but our growth rate.
As a percentage, 1%, less than 1%?
Well, it's very difficult to predict right now. If I'm not mistaken, worldwide there might be around 15 to 17 or even more billion bottles of wine. So you can see that from a market share point of view, it's a niche product still.
Excellent. Again, in Siegfried, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Vinalock is one of many closures, and if you want to get a good overview of closures, I have an excellent page on the 3050.co.uk website in the UK Wine Show section. Select wine closures on the left-hand side, and there's a load of interviews and information about the different closure systems. Next week, we're going to be talking with George Fistovich. George is the owner of one of the largest and most successful New Zealand wineries, Villa Maria. We talked to him about how it's grown from almost nothing to its current powerful position, and on the week that the IWSC gave one of Villa Maria's Sauvignon Blancs gold best in class, we find out why their catchphrase is the most awarded wine company. Now, I'm not sure if Villa Maria grows many of the mystery grapes, but it is certainly grown in Hawke's Bay in New Zealand. Did anybody work it out? It was, of course, Malbec, Argentina's main grape. I was wondering if the Bordeaux reference threw you out a bit, but it was grown a lot in Bordeaux before Phylloxera, and it lost out to Cabernet Sauvignon during the replanting. It is still a permitted grape, and it is grown a wee bit in Bordeaux. Here are the clues again. The black Malbec grape is used to make red wine in Bordeaux, the Loire, and southwest France, where it goes under a range of different names. It's known as Pressac in Bordeaux, Auxerrois in Cahors, and Cot in the Loire. In Argentina, its adopted land, Malbec has grown in quality and quantity, and now successfully exported around the world. The grape can create both fruit-driven plummy-like characteristics, but in Cahors it tends to be gamey aromas and suitable for quite considerable aging potential. That's mainly due to the tannins. A mid-season ripener in Bordeaux, Malbec can bring deep colour and ample tannins to create a great base for blended wines. It's also grown in New Zealand, Chile, California and Australia, where it's used in blends more than as a single varietal. Okay, that almost ends this week's show. One thing left is our quote. This week's quote is from the 16th century book Garfantua. The smell of wine, oh, how much more delicate, cheerful, gratifying, celestial and delicious it is than olive oil. I'd hope so. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.